to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com. Today, Nate and Ed Legg continue their discussion of Michelangelo Matos's Can't Slow Down, how 1984 became pop's blockbuster year, with a look at Prince's triumphant Purple Rain. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. Or should I say, it's time to 80s roll. That's right, I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, welcoming back Ed Legg, the Freebird Yeller, to continue our discussion of Michelangelo Matos's Can't Slow Down, how 1984 became pop's blockbuster year. This time, we're at Van's Chinese Theater, Hollywood, California, July 26, 1984, and it's finally time for Prince and Purple Rain. Ed, did you think we'd ever make it?
You know, it's like we're moving into finally into hyperspace.
It really is. Warp drives engaged. I mean, Michael carried us for the first part of the year pretty excitedly. And you know, there was the British Invasion and Cyndi Lauper and lots of fun. But then that victory tour was a massive bummer in the last chapter. And I was ready. I was ready for some Prince. And for one thing, the listening last week was a painful chore, which is the first time it's happened. And this week, I mean, it was a delight. It was a delight. The Purple One, all hail Prince Rogers Nelson. That's all I got to say.
Amen, brother.
But let's dive into this. He starts up actually with, he wraps up kind of the last chapter. He talks about LaDonna Jones. LaDonna Jones is the 11-year-old girl who was saving her newspaper money to buy tickets to see the Jacksons. When she found out it was going to be $28 a ticket and you had to buy four of them, that priced it out of her range. So she wrote a letter to the Dallas Morning News that got picked up. And so she gets to go. It ended up that the Jacksons sent a limo to pick her up. They took her backstage. She got to meet Michael and the other brothers. So happy ending there. Then they segue into one of the most horrific events of 1984, the James Uberty, I'm Hunting Humans mass shooting at the McDonald's in San Diego. And this is back when mass shootings didn't happen every week.
Right.
And were really traumatic for the whole country. I mean, not that they're not traumatic now, but it's just we're kind of numbed to them. But at that point, I mean, there was as I always bring up Time Magazine, but there was a multi-page spread in Time Magazine about this. And it really added to a level of paranoia around the Jacksons' camp. And then they also talk about Eddie Van Halen showing up to play Beat It live there at Texas Stadium with Dallas. But then, as always with Matos, he makes a smooth transition because somebody else is backstage, and that's Prince. And, you know, beautiful connection, beautiful segue. And from that point, it's the Purple One all the way through for the rest of the chapter. And he mentions that Prince showed up backstage at Texas Stadium to see the Jacksons with Alan Leeds. And Alan Leeds is like a Let It Roll legend because he was the road manager for James Brown somebody else in the 70s. And I can't remember who. But anyway, major dude, major music business dude. And he was Prince's road manager too. Lighting director Roy Bennett, his security team, his massive security team, big chick leading the way, percussionist Jerome Benton. From the time. And so I thought that was an interesting crew. I mean, who do you bring to see the biggest concert? You bring your road manager, your lighting director, your security team, and somebody from your opening act. It seems pretty clear like this was a business trip for Prince.
I think everything was with him. He was very business minded, and he even acts that way in the movie.
It's true. He basically from what you can tell, he played himself in the movie.
Yeah.
Did you go back and watch it again for this?
No, I did not. I confess. I have seen it since 1984, but it's been a while. When I moved to Minnesota, I watched it. I was, you know what? I was thinking about it a lot, which I know counts for nothing. You probably did go back and look, didn't you?
I did, but I did it when we started the book, and then I went back and watched some favorite scenes for this one. I think Michael Gilmore called it the Citizen Kane of rock movies, and I think that's a bit much, but it's a pretty good movie, and the performance stuff is just priceless, and it's such a big part of the legend of Prince that I think it holds up quite well. It kicks the crap out of Footloose and Flashdance, I'll tell you that.
Very true.
not even close. But go ahead.
Were you old enough to see it in the theater when it came out?
Oh yeah, I was 15. I took a date.
There you go.
Yeah, I did too. Your dad drove
Beyonce.
Well,
way to go, man. Way to go. Well, I mean, to me, I don't want to get ahead of things, but that's not the way that movie. The way that movie showed up at that point, and the Victory Tour had been going on a little while, but when I remember just seeing the first ad for the trailer for Purple Rain on a Saturday night, and it just had so much excitement in it, and I didn't see it coming. Now maybe other people did and knew what was coming, and you know, it's reflected in the book. He doesn't foreshadow it very much, and there was so much going on. There was so much density in that year already, and then all of a sudden, August, and here comes Purple Rain.
Yeah, and I mean, and it very much is like a torch passing. I mean, it was very much like Michael had been so hot, and the accomplishment of Thriller was so overwhelming. But that was 1983, and it had already run its course. And Michael was planning to take 84 off and gets dragged into this, you know, ill thought out Victory Tour with his brothers, and clearly stumbled. And Prince just takes over. I mean, takes over. And the Purple Rain album essentially took over from Thriller at the top of the charts for the next 6 months. I mean, this, you know, just a monumental accomplishment. And really, the opening was going to be there one way or the other. Either Michael was going to take the year off, in which case Prince would have had the whole lane to himself, or Michael was going to do the Victory Tour, in which case Prince essentially still had the lane to himself. And, you know, and then with the tragedy of the, you know, the explosion on the set of the Pepsi commercial and his hair catching on fire and everything, you know, like we talked about, Michael hit that point where he hit turbulence, and these career arcs, you very rarely see somebody hit, you know, once they're going up. And once they start going down, they, you know, you don't regain your upward altitude. Not very often anyway. And, you know, Michael certainly, I mean, it was an impossible task to match Thriller, but he certainly never came close. And Prince more than matched Thriller. Well, I mean, he didn't obviously quite match the commercial success of Thriller, but, and maybe it's because I'm a rockist and not a dance fan.
I thought that word about myself today, thinking about this phenomenon, because I was totally into that movie. And people who I know, like I went and saw it, I think the opening weekend, and then ran into some people who were my age or older, which is, you know, mid-20s, and they were asking me about it. People were talking about it, and nobody ever asked me if I was going to see the Victory Tour. There was something exciting and new about it.
Yeah,
Purple Rain.
It absolutely was, and it just took over. But let's go ahead and hear some Prince. This is from 1979, all right, from the Prince album, Why You Wanna Treat Me So Bad. And that was Why You Want to Treat Me So Bad from Prince's second album, the self-titled Prince album. And yeah, and then from there, I do want to get one Quincy Jones quote, though. He compared Prince to Stevie Wonder. So he said about Prince, "That cat is really talented. I met Stevie at age 15, and there was never any doubt what he was going to be. I think Prince has it too." I mean, that is heady praise, because Stevie Wonder is essentially a musical god, you know, one of the greatest stars of the 70s and one of the great Motown stars of the 60s, and also a musical prodigy, like literally a Beethoven level musical prodigy. And Prince had that same, you know, brought that same level of firepower to the table, and you know, somebody like Quincy Jones can recognize, and he did, you know. And I also liked this quote from Albert Magnoli, who directed Purple Rain, and he said, "There was always artistic competitiveness between Michael Jackson and Prince, but they never had a harsh word to say about each other, ever. Prince honored Michael Jackson." And I think that's important, that, you know, to know, and that the two of them, but I mean, for one thing, they were at a distance. They were never on the same record label. They didn't come out of Motown together or anything like that. They were never competing, you know, in the same stall. It's not like they were, you know, kittens with the same mother or whatever. They were never fighting over the same tit. They both had their own space. Prince, you know, obviously ruled Minneapolis, and Michael is a citizen of the world. So, you know, they had some distance, so they could respect each other from a distance and admire each other from a distance. But I think it is touching is probably a bit much, but I like knowing that they respected each other and didn't trash each other. And then Matos tells the story from the August 1983 show. James Brown was playing in Hollywood, I think, and he knew Michael Jackson was in the crowd, and he invited him up on stage. And Michael does a star turn on there, but just goes along with the band. He basically dances with James Brown, but then he tells James that Prince is in the crowd, and James Brown invites Prince up. And when I watched that video, have you watched that video of James Brown?
No, I haven't. No, but I mean, I was thinking about that in regard to Prince and how, it's a easy word to say, is imperious. I mean, he's kind of like a king. Go ahead. Yeah, and it makes sense based on all the third-hand stuff I heard when I lived in Minnesota about the, you know, his the potentate, the whole thing that he did. But go ahead and tell the story.
Well, so Prince gets on and like tries to take over, and it just didn't work. and he tried to do some guitar stuff, and basically, you know, was kind of stripping his clothes off and just overreached, and it didn't work. And I think I might be imagining this, but I think Matos said something, you know, that Prince needed to be an unchallenged star. Like he didn't work in a group environment. And I think that that's a classic case. But how do you really plug in with James Brown and Michael Jackson anyway? For James and Michael, it's pretty easy since they're both such epic dancers. I mean, Prince could move, but he wasn't a dancer in that sense. And you know, it just kind of didn't fit. But then Matos gets into the whole Prince story, and sure enough, he was a prodigy. He had taught himself over two dozen instruments before he finished high school. He's also taken music biz classes in high school. And I thought it was interesting that he, from a very young age, conceptualized his strategy. And essentially he said that since Minneapolis was 3 months late on everything, like every trend, every record, every outfit, he just decided to, quote, do my own thing. Otherwise, when we split Minneapolis, we'd be way behind and dated. And he realized that he had to come out of left field, essentially, that he wasn't in New York, he wasn't in LA, and he didn't want to move. And that he wasn't going to be able to be like up to the minute unless he just did his own thing. And we'll talk about this more later, but the Matos seems to zero in on the fact that Minneapolis had a very small black population, like 2.4% of the Twin Cities was black. And that's the Twin Cities. Like, imagine what the rest of Minnesota is like.
It's not hard. I've been there. It is whiter than white.
Whiter than white. And not just whiter than white, but Norwegianer than Norwegian. I'm a white guy, and I feel very foreign in Minneapolis. And I haven't been there a lot, but it's if you're a Texan or a Southerner or whatever, it's extremely culturally alien. It's very, very, very different. And people are a lot more restrained and more polite. It's just a whole different culture. And if you're Black, I imagine it's a real challenge. And, you know, super small minority in the Twin Cities and completely just absent from the rest of the state for the most part. And I thought it was interesting that Terry Lewis he said basically that the R&B stations in the Twin Cities got such poor reception that all they could hear was the beat, so that all the Black kids ended up listening to the rock stations as much as they listened to the R&B. And I think that was kind of ended up being Prince's secret weapon, was that he brought this massive infusion of rock influence. I mean, and not that there hadn't been plenty of Black bands that essentially played rock. I mean, you know, the Isley Brothers, Parliament Funkadelic, I mean, you know, that's quote unquote funk, but it's also heavy rock a lot of the time. I mean, Ernie Isley was this great guitar player, heavy rock guitar player.
Yeah.
Who literally was a student of Jimi Hendrix. And, you know, Prince was paying close attention to those guys and definitely paying close attention to Funkadelic, but he was also paying attention to all the white rock that was out there. And Santana comes up, you know, as a big factor. And anyway, it's just interesting to me that was kind of his secret weapon, that he took that cultural isolation of being Black in Minneapolis and turned that into a real asset, that he was representing this unique scene. And I mean, just the fact that a guy out of Minneapolis became one of the most important Black musicians in America is really an amazing accomplishment. And it wasn't just him. There was a whole scene behind him. And Matos talks about the Time and Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, who were originally in the Time until Prince fires him. And you know, the Revolution and all these guys. There was a whole scene, a whole lot of talent spinning around there. But let's go ahead and hear our next song. And this is Prince, When You Were Mine, off the Dirty Mind album. And that was When You Were Mine, Prince's classic track from the Dirty Mind album. And he goes into talking about the band. And, you know, Matt Fink, a.k.a. Dr. Fink, who frequently dressed up like a surgeon on stage. That was his surgeon costume, who was in the Revolution. He joined the touring band after For You, after Prince's first album. And brought in he grew up with the Rivkin Brothers, which is Bobby Z, the drummer, and then engineer David Z, who were part of the Prince team as well. And Matt Fink wrote that keyboard line from When You Were Mine. So I thought that was interesting that you know, you tend to think of Prince as this one-man show, but he actually he kept his ears open and drew on he collaborated with people for a reason. Like he had a keen eye for talent and brought people into his world. And what I think he really brought, besides the prodigy level talent, was the vision and the concept. I mean, you know, from the beginning, Prince is writing songs that are going to be hits for other people. And he's recognizing that doesn't fit the Prince persona. I can't use that. And to me, I'm just kind of in awe of people who have that kind of conceptual ability and can, you know, visualize and conceptualize what they're doing to that degree. And it's interesting to me also, like when they tell the story, Montage tells the story of how when the band made their debut outside of Minneapolis in November of 1979, and he goes up to the band and gives them a big talk beforehand and says, I want every member of their band to have their own persona, and I'm going to personify sex in every possible way. Which he went on to do. And, you know, but to, I don't know. That's the kind of thing that when you read about the Beatles that they were thinking about. I'm sure Michael Jackson was thinking in that same way, and Madonna or anybody at that level is thinking about a lot more than just chords and notes. They're thinking about the persona they're creating and the story they're going to tell. And Prince is obviously one of the best at that. Were you aware of Prince at all in the late 70s? When did you first?
I actually was. And I you mentioned how you felt and being from the South and being in Minneapolis. This is going to sound probably strange, but Athens, Georgia felt kind of like that too. University of Georgia, I don't know what the percentage of African-American students is now, but it was pretty small when I went there in the late 70s. I could count on two hands. I knew a lot of black kids, partly because I went to a black high school, and at least one came after I did. And the first thing he said to me when I bumped into him was, where'd all these white people come from? And I mean, and it's only, you know, it's only an hour and a half from Atlanta. You know, it's not even it's not that far, but it's just harder to get to. And it's a little more agrarian. And there's certainly places like Columbus, where I did eventually live, in Albany, where when you see the voting and the purplization of Georgia, you know, and you see that blue across kind of the lower center, that is more African-American, and it is also rural. But Athens definitely wasn't. And it was certainly an adjustment, because I'd gone to a majority black high school. And then all of a sudden I'm not only, it was a majority rural college in a lot of ways, kids from, you know, all over the state that weren't just from the medium sized towns, but were from, you know, super white parts of Georgia too. But you know what you're talking, I was told by somebody who was a musician, he was older. I have no idea if this is true, but he claims that Prince got all of his funk chops from white guys, because there's this huge white funk culture, music culture ahead of Prince, like older boomers in Minneapolis. And, you know, that's where Funky, the guys that did Funky Town, that's a white guy that did that. I don't think the singer is white, but the guy that put together Lips Incorporated was a white guy. And I met the bass player at one point, and tons of white guys playing funk, supposedly.
Well, I mean, they pulled it off. Lips.
Yes.
I think joke. I mean, you know, but yeah, I mean, you just look at a picture of them, and there are three white guys in a seven-person group. Four white guys.
Yes. Okay.
And it might be five. And with three black members. So I mean, there was definitely a scene there that
yes, there was. Prince,
that preceded Prince. And you know, he, Matos talks about how he had been cutting demos with a local band called Champagne, and the studio owner named Chris Moon, who was British, noticed Prince out of the whole group, that he was like, Prince is the guy, and cuts a songwriting deal with him. And originally they have a 50-50 songwriting deal, and they co-wrote Soft and Wet. So Moon must have been bringing something to the songwriting table, you know, if he co-wrote that. And then when Prince wrote Soft and Wet, or Moon and he wrote it together, Moon goes, I think you have your whole marketing strategy worked out. And so,
and then which he did.
Yeah.
Which was true.
Yeah. You know, and it's also funny that Matos points out that he liked, Moon liked Prince for his lack of ego. which that changed.
Yeah.
But, you know, he was only 19 years old when he signed with Warner Brothers and was given a deal that allowed him to self-produce his own records, which clearly people were impressed with this kid. You know, I mean, not every 19-year-old gets a Warner Brothers contract, and they certainly don't get permission to self-produce. I mean, you know, you don't see that in the glam metal bands, for example. You know,
sure.
it took Eddie Van Halen almost a decade before he was able to produce his own records. You know, a decade of selling platinum levels of records. But one other thing I want to mention is that Matos points out that Prince recruited a deliberate mix of white and black and male and female players, that he modeled that on Sly and the Family Stone. And you know, very genius. And I think that, in combination with his guitar heroics and the color purple, which is associated with Jimi Hendrix because of Purple Haze, he kind of, my first impression, when I didn't hear of Prince until Little Red Corvette. And when I first saw that video, I literally thought he was I had just seen Woodstock. And I was really blown away by Sly and the Family Stone. And obviously everybody's blown away by Jimi Hendrix, you know, version of Star Spangled Banner at Woodstock. And I really just thought, wow, Sly and Jimmy had a kid, and here he is.
Yeah.
And you know, just totally combined those two guys. And but it's interesting, those early records, I think I bought either For You or Prince in the discount bin. And was really disappointed that it wasn't more like rock, and it wasn't, I liked Funkadelic too, and it wasn't really like heavy funk. It was like smoother than I liked. And but it was interesting that Matos talks about in concert, Prince was way more guitar oriented. He cranked his guitar loud on every song, and not just on the rockers, but on all the tunes. And so, well, let's take a sponsor break, and we'll talk a little bit more about Prince's evolution as he moves towards Purple Rain.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shouted Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
All One thing that I thought was interesting, Matos points out how quickly Prince learns and adjusts, that he spent 6 months making his first album For You. And I think he played all the instruments on that, totally one-man show. And then in Prince, he does it in 6 weeks, just focuses on busting it out. And that's where he gets his first major hit, I Want to Be Your Lover, which I thought was a top 10 hit, but Matos says it only made it to number 11. But that got him on American Bandstand. And, you know, I might have seen that, actually. But anyway,
I did. You know, and when you asked me, it was the first time I realized that Prince wasn't a porn. I thought it was I thought it must be a porn album when I saw Dirty Mind. And I know that it was so outré. And then I saw him perform. I think I saw the video for I Want to Be Your Lover, and I was like, oh. You know, when he had his hair straight and he was wearing jeans, and but he looked cool and he sounded, you know, I was like, oh, that's Prince. You know, that's pretty good. And I never answered your question. The way I found out about Prince was a contributor to the student newspaper, who happened to be African-American, reviewed Prince's concert in Atlanta for the paper. And that's how I found out, you know, more about him than, oh, this isn't a porn album. You know, I mean, that cover just really, it got my attention, I guess. It did what it was supposed to do.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's like, you're sort of, at first glance, it looks like your classic 70s album, because he's wearing like a heavy jacket and a kerchief, but he's shirtless.
Yeah.
Which is like, you know, everybody's shirtless. You've seen a lot of male skin on record covers, but he's also wearing a Speedo and no pants. And, you know, so as your eyes follow that line down, you're kind of like, whoa, what is that? You know? And, I can remember the Hastings in my hometown, that was a local record store. They would not display that record. They would turn it. They would only show the back cover of it in the racks, but anyway, that might have just been one out of the control manager. But it's one thing I learned that I didn't know. I mean, Prince has so much unreleased stuff, but that he had cut a whole heavy rock album called Rebels that was unreleased. He cut that in 1979 after his first two records, and he kind of stepped back and is just a member of that band. It's his regular band that he had at the time, which was Des Dickerson on guitar, Andre Simone on bass, Matt Fink on keyboard, Gail Chapman, who kind of had the Lisa role where she flipped back and forth between guitars and keyboards, and Bobby Z on drums. And he basically, I don't think Gail Chapman was in Rebels, I could be wrong, but basically kind of stepped back and let the other guys kind of drive and did a rock album. And it's pretty good. It kind of reminds me, there was a punk band out of Philly, a black punk band out of Philly called Pure Hell, that it kind of reminds me of, but it's way more produced than that. It's not really punk, but it's more like Rick James influenced or Police style, where they've got all the synthesizers and all the production stuff that punk bands usually either didn't have access to or didn't want anything to do with.
But with the soaring guitar, like the Loverboy soaring guitar stuff.
Yeah.
That was when I took your recommendation and listened to it. And that was what I heard that part of the rock. And he really did. It's astounding that. And I mean, I was talking to a buddy of mine today about a musician friend about Hendrix, and he worships Hendrix. And I mean, and because Hendrix was such a pioneer and such a, you know, a freak the way he played. And Prince seems to have been that good. At least that kind of talent.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But, you know, the Loverboy reference, I think, is actually right, because I'll have to go back and listen to some more Loverboy, because Prince's guitar style really doesn't have anything to do with Hendrix. And he says himself that he didn't listen to Hendrix that much, that by the time he got records and stuff, Hendrix was long dead.
Yeah.
And he doesn't really sound like Ernie Isley either. I bet it was AOR rock guys. The dude's out of Boston too, I think he sounds like.
Ah, good point.
That is interesting. It's definitely that Loverboy guitar. I hadn't even thought about that. But yeah, it absolutely is. It's amazing. I never noticed that before. But anyway, they also talk about how, as part of the stage act, that Gail Chapman and Prince would make out on stage every night on these early tours, and that was part of a factor of her leaving the band early on. And that is not something you could get away with in the Me Too era. I don't think that what Prince was doing back then would fly. But of course, it was the early 80s, a very different sexual ethos than got today, for sure. And of course, they talk about the tour, the 9-week tour opening for Rick James, which I've covered Rick James twice, and that's a huge part of the Rick James story. That's kind of like the worst thing that ever happened to Rick James.
I believe it.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, Rick James took so long to get to the top, and when he finally does, here comes Prince, just, you know, right on his heels. I mean, I think Rick James had only been a major star for like 2 years at that point. And the thing about Rick James is he was older. So that kind of explains why he didn't, you know, his body of work is kind of less accomplished than somebody like George Clinton or Prince, because he basically got a late start. And you know, music is a young person's game a lot of the times. But, you know, they talk about the big rivalry. And then they talk about Gail Chapman quitting and being replaced by Lisa Coleman, who, of course, goes on to become a big part of Purple Rain and the Revolution. And then they talk about how Dirty Mind had freaked out the Warner Brothers executives. Matos has a great line. He says that they had been expecting Stevie Wonder and got a cross between Stevie and Johnny Rotten. But
wearing a Speedo.
Or a thong, actually. Steph reminds me it's actually a thong, not a Speedo, with thigh-high heeled boots on.
Yeah.
With that. So, I mean, and I think that the way I used to always wonder how Prince got away with playing with his sexuality so much and being so androgynous in the Black community, which is, you know, infamously homophobic. But I think his persona, that he was personifying sex in every possible way, he just defined himself as such a freak that nobody really got into parsing what kind of freaky he was into, you know.
Interesting.
And you know, they he just created this way larger than life persona that was so sexual. But Dirty Mind, you know, pushed Warner Brothers was famous for their tolerance. You know, Mo Austin was all about the artists and everything. And initially, the Warner Brothers executives were resisting Dirty Mind, but I don't know if Prince appealed higher up or if Mo Austin just got word of it. But Mo Austin and the top executives backed Prince and backed Dirty Mind. And the album started slow. The tour was rocky. They played the Ritz in New York City, which normally would be a huge gig. You know, for a band, for an act like Prince that had, you know, coming off of a very successful second album and with a really great third album. But they played, I think, on December 10th, 1980, which was one day after John Lennon was murdered. So only the club was half full, you know, so that just, you know, had to be a drag. Although Andy Warhol came. But, you know, I'm sure Prince cared about stuff like that. But by the time they get to Denver, you know, the tour's picking up and girls are mobbing him. But let's go ahead and hear our next song. This is Prince, Let's Pretend We're Married, from the 1999 album. And that was Let's Pretend We're Married from the 1999 album. I'm just picking personal favorites. I've always loved that song. Although I was always confused because Delirious has a keyboard line that sounds exactly like Let's Pretend We're Married. And Let's Pretend We're Married doesn't sound, the melody isn't quite that. But anyway, that's a side point. But then Matos kind of shifts gears and starts talking about First Avenue Club. which is, of course, going to be very important in the Purple Rain movie. It was originally the Depot in 1970. Then it closed after a year. Then it was part of a disco chain called Uncle Sam's for most of the 70s. Then it became Sam's, which was a new wave club in 1980, and had a wide booking policy with dance nights with DJs playing, quote, what Matos calls the same kind of mix that Prince was. So I assume there's a nice mix of you know, black funk and white rock. And then co-founder Alan Fingerhut would let Prince in to see black bands. And it was very unusual for a white rock club to book black bands in this period. And I wonder if, because Minneapolis had so few black people, if maybe that didn't contribute to the white people being maybe a little bit less racist than we are in most places. Like,
it does. That is absolutely true. I mean, at one time, Minnesota had an African American pro football, the Vikings football coach, the athletic director at the University of Minnesota, but definitely the basketball coach at the University of Minnesota was African American. That's very true. Bobby McFerrin ended up having a residency there for a long time, as did August Wilson. Had a long term in St. Paul, became like a poet and, you know, residence there. So, yeah. Playwright in residence, sorry. So it has that element, and I lived there during that time, and it doesn't come off as tokenism. You know, it's legitimate. But it's different from, say, Atlanta, which had a black mayor in the 1970s when I lived there, you know, in which my middle school, we had a black principal, and to me was as much, he was an authority figure. That was what I saw him as. And then we had actually a African-American policeman on the force of the town I lived in, who stopped me for potential drug possession, which he was close, but no cigar. But I saw him as an oppressive cop, you know. Yeah, and no. And that's how it was in Minnesota when I lived there in the, you know, the 90s mainly.
Yeah.
So, well, of course, but you're right, that's very astute.
Yeah, but George Floyd was murdered by the police in Minnesota.
True.
Still racist, but maybe just yep. In this particular aspect of being more open and booking black bands in a time when most white rock clubs were completely apartheid, there's a little bit more of a mixed scene here. And then they talk about Prince's March 1981 debut at First Avenue, which I'm not sure if it was still Sam's or if it had changed. I guess it was still Sam's at that point, but that it was, quote, the stuff of instant legend. You could see him connecting. I had a sense that he felt like, this is my audience. That was DJ Kevin Cole, who worked at the club there. And then it becomes First Avenue in 1982. And then he introduces Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, because Jam worked at the same record store as Kevin Cole, who was the DJ at First Avenue. And they were also close by the Fox Trap, which was a more conventional black R&B club. But by 1981, Jam and Lewis had fallen into Prince's orbit. Prince had Jam and Lewis cut some demos that became the Times debut album. He added his old drummer, Morris Day, as their vocalist, replaced the vocalist in the Time with Morris Day, and then basically took over, wrote all the songs on the albums, and kind of puppeteered the whole band, but created a real alternative to himself and the Revolution with the Time. And it was also interesting, Matos quotes, I'm not sure if it's Jam or Lewis, but they were watching Prince very closely in the studio and noticed that he recorded everything in the red. And when you record, there's a needle back in the analog days. And when things were too loud, when the mics were being overworked, the needle would go into the red, and that shows you're getting distorted. And Prince made sure everything was a little bit in the red, because his theory being that when the human ear hears distorted sound, it assumes it's loud. So kind of an early part of the compression wars, I guess. But Jimmy Jam calls it, quotes, Prince is the Minneapolis sound. People like us, Vanity and the Time, are sort of like his children. I think that's definitely true. I mean, Prince crystallized this sound. And then, you know, Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis obviously took it all over the world, producing so many records for so many people, but definitely are coming from that same school of thought as Prince. And then October 1981, the Time debuts at Sam's. And the fact that Prince stayed in Minneapolis, you know, Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, even after Prince fired them from the Time, they kept that thing, that same ethos. And they said, the only thing we do in Los Angeles is master the product and pick up the check. And I like that attitude. I mean, it's just total regionalism. And it really worked out for Minneapolis and for all those artists. But Prince fired Jam and Lewis for missing some Time shows because they were producing the SOS band in Atlanta and got trapped in a snowstorm, which how often does that happen in Atlanta? But it does.
Once a year.
Yeah, I've been stuck in a snowstorm in Charleston, South Carolina, which was the longest week of my life. But
I know. Yeah. You're not prepared for it.
No, they were not. And I was not prepared for Charleston in the snow either. But but he points out that in 1981, that it was a new dark age of R&B crossover, that only 8 R&B hits made the year-end top pop 40, and which was only half of the number of R&B hits that made the pop charts in 1980. And he talks about how, you know, the AOR color line was so strong back then that you know, if you were a black rock act, you were really should have a luck because they, yeah. You know, you couldn't be marketed to R&B radio because you're not R&B, but you couldn't be marketed to rock radio because you're not white. I mean, it was just, you know, created this total dilemma. And I think Prince really broke down those color barriers in a massive way. I mean, after Prince, that you didn't really have that. And let's hear our last song, and then we'll talk a little bit more about the strategy that Prince and his management used to break him with multiple audiences at the same time. But let's hear, this is one of the famous B-sides. Prince is famous for his unreleased tracks and his great B-sides, and this is 17 Days. And that was 17 Days by Prince. I can't remember what that's the B-side to, but it's one of his famous B-sides. And then, yeah, Steph's getting anxious to hear about Purple Rain. She's like, is he not going to talk about the movie? Well, we got to get there. And maybe we're behind schedule. But one thing I thought was interesting was that they had a deliberate strategy when he toured that he would frequently play 2 gigs in the same market. And their goal would be to open for a major black act like Cameo or Parliament, plus get a gig at a local new wave or dance club. And the manager conceived the strategy was like, and you won't have any audience overlap. And he was totally right. And that really helped Prince. And then he talks about how Prince, you know, built his whole career on tweaking the moral majority, despite the fact that he liked Reagan. But he just existed to upset people like Jerry Falwell. And, you know, but then he talks about how he opened for the Rolling Stones in 1981 and was booed and pelted with garbage. And that was the last time he opened for anybody. And, you know, he's in good company there because Stevie Wonder had also been booed and pelted with garbage when he opened up for the Stones, I think, in 73. And it's just a classic testimony to the racism of the rock audience in this period of time. Well, go ahead.
I'll tell you this. 75, the Meters were the Stones opening act in Atlanta. And that was probably I saw Elton John a year before, and that was the most diverse audience I was ever at a rock concert with, because he had by then crossed over into black stations with Benny and the Jets and everything. But by the Stones. I mean, the Meters were super funky, heavy duty funk, and they did not get booed. And I never felt, I had no bad vibe or anything. The Who comes in November that year. This was in July, the Stones were. And then The Who comes in November. Toots and the Maytals, the reggae band, were the opening act. There was no bad vibe there until they played country, a reggae version of Country Roads by John Denver. And they were booed. But I'm glad you're laughing. I think it's because of the song.
Yeah.
Nobody was booing them until that song. And it just wasn't a big favorite at that point. They were not winning converts by playing, you know, this John Denver song. And yeah. And I wonder if Prince would have been. I want to think that Prince wouldn't have gotten that treatment in Atlanta. I don't know. I mean, it makes me sick to read that about him. And there was a part white, part black band called Mother's Finest. Have you ever heard of them?
Oh, yeah, I remember Mother's Finest.
They were middle of the bill on several of the big summer stadium festivals in Atlanta from like 78 to 81. And the last time I saw him was headlining at the Fox Theater, which is a 4,000 seater in 81. But and they got rock airplay in Atlanta, and I saw them and Aerosmith more times than any other band here. Between the end of high school, I saw the end of high school and the end of college, I saw Mother's Finest and Aerosmith the most times, just because I had opportunities. But they, you know, and they were really good, and they were, you know, they were playing to white audiences. I saw them at a club, Mother's Finest, and it was mostly, in fact, it was mostly underage. I mean, I was 18 by then. It was mostly underage audience. They got received at the festivals, but they didn't break big. You know, they didn't break huge.
Yeah, I'd have to look into that. But at the Stone Show in Atlanta, was the audience more black than it was in other cities, you think?
I do not think that. I may be completely wrong.
White audience, at least.
Maybe so. I would like to think that. I don't know if it's true. like to think that.
But back to Prince. And so Matos is talking about the color line in AOR, and he says that, you know, Michael Jackson was the pebble that started the avalanche, but Prince was the test case for breaking the MTV and album-oriented rock color barriers, and that he did it with the 1999 album, that even though 1999 got limited AOR play, Little Red Corvette broke straight through and made it to number six. And then, and he's playing arenas by 1999 or 1983 on the 1999 tour, playing 12 to 15,000 seat arenas. So he's breaking through right there. And Matos also, and I think because he's a dance guy, that he explained this in a way. I'd never thought of it this way before. It's probably pretty obvious to most people, but he views 1999 as a collection of long, creatively unfurling dance tracks that play as an homage to the 12-inch dance singles that were dominating pop's creative edge, from UK synth pop like New Order and Depeche Mode to New York City post-disco labels like West End and Prelude. And, you know, this is stuff like the Peach Boys, Larry Levin's group. There was a real killer underground dance scene going on in New York at that time. And of course, Prince was hip to that stuff. And of course, Prince was hip to the synth pop that was coming out of England at that time, and combining it all together. And that makes perfect sense, because 1999, you know, it's got those longer tracks, but they don't feel like jam tracks. They're dance tracks. And aha, of course, he's making a whole album of 12 inches. And then, but by 1983, City Pages in Minneapolis is already wondering, you know, when will Prince make his first movie? And boom, he cuts the deal to make Purple Rain. And he's taking acting and dancing lessons from the Minnesota Dance Theater. I love that. And he paid for it by doing a benefit for him that raised $25,000. And and the benefits on debut Purple Rain, I Would Die For You, and Baby I'm a Star. This was August of 83. And they're actually cutting album tracks live that night at that benefit. And so then he rented First Avenue, the club, for $100,000 for a month. And unfortunately for Vanity, his girlfriend and the leader of Vanity Six, she was going to be the big co-star of the movie, but she was fired after Prince and she broke up. He did buy new lighting gear for the First Avenue Club, but then Matos talks about the scene during the filming. It was just mayhem, cocaine fuel, 24/7, people working around the clock, you know, cutting performance scenes at 9 a.m. and stuff like that. And, you know, just part of the workload that Prince was on. He also cut 6 albums in 83 and 84. He's got Purple Rain and Around the World in a Day. I guess he cut 1999 and 82. And then he cuts the Sheila E. album. And he talks about how Sheila E. and Prince had met way back in the 70s when she was with Santana and had played in Minneapolis. But he also cuts an album on The Time. He cuts an album for Apollonia 6, which Apollonia was the replacement for Vanity. She became the co-star of the movie. And then a new band, The Family, which was his replacement for The Time, which he had basically gutted by firing Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. And he'd also done the Sugar Wall single for Sheena Easton, Manic Monday for the Bengals, and then played keyboards on Stevie Nicks' Stand Back. So just, you know, busy, busy dude, busy, busy dude. And then it talks about Erotic City, which was never released as a single, but he talks about it got so much radio play that had it been released as a single, it would have charted at least on the dance charts. And it was so prolific that he gave Albert Magnoli, the director of the movie, 100 songs to choose from for the soundtrack. I mean,
yeah, it staggers just, belief. It's hard to believe.
Yeah, it's just incredible. I mean, the guy was so talented and so hardworking and creative. I was just reading a biography of Beethoven, and must have been like Beethoven. Beethoven basically didn't have any other hobbies or anything. I mean, Prince did like his sex, but he wasn't a big druggie or anything. But he must have just really been working nonstop. I mean, you know, it's just an amazing.
I agree.
Amazing amount of
it is.
Yeah, of material. And you got to shout out Morris Day. And you know, Matos gives him his due because he said he stole every scene he was in Purple Rain. And he really did. He comes out of that movie a huge star. And unfortunately, because Prince had gutted the band by firing Jam and Lewis, you know, The Time had already basically broken up by the time the movie came out. And Morris Day's cocaine use and bad behavior on the set and his feud with Prince kind of brought it sputtering to a halt. So The Time, I think The Time is one of the kind of the great lost bands because Prince over-dominated their, you know, he was using them as another vehicle for his productivity. And I just, on the one hand, without Prince, there wouldn't be The Time. But a band with Morris Day, Jimmy Jam, and Terry Lewis should have been writing their own songs and should have had a good long run. So
yeah, I agree.
You know, and then Jesse Johnson was no joke either. He was a guitar player. He co-wrote Jungle Love and The Bird and, you know, and worked on Janet Jackson's Dream Street album. But, you know, by the time I Stream Castles comes out as a huge hit, the band had already broken up and moved on. So, you know, anyway, but I guess we need to wrap pretty quick, but we'll talk about the debut of the movie. And it talks about the guest list that Warner Brothers got together to be at Man's Chinese Theater. And you've got Morgan Fairchild. You've got Christopher Reeve, Superman, Eddie Murphy. But you've also got John Cougar Mellencamp. And I didn't know this. John Cougar Mellencamp was such a huge Prince fan that when A Little Red Corvette came out, he went on stage at one of his concerts and held up a boombox to the mic and said, y'all need to listen to this.
Which maybe he thought, and maybe there was the reason I heard it. I've told you this before, is because I moved to Columbus, Georgia. It wasn't on rock radio in Birmingham or Atlanta, and because I lived in both places when that song was big. Prince wasn't on those stations at that point, and not until I moved. So maybe that's why John Cougar thought he needed to do that.
Oh, well, you know, got to spread the word. But, you know, you also have Talking Heads there and Weird Al Yankovic and Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham from Fleetwood Mac. You know, and then talks about how Alan Leeds has an anecdote that the one time he saw Prince freak out and blink kind of in the face of what was going on was when they were driving to the Purple Rain debut, and the crowds are so thick that they're blocking traffic, and all of a sudden Prince just clutches his hand and holds his hand. And I don't know, that kind of was a sweet thought. I mean, what a big honor to be the guy that Prince shows his vulnerability to. You know, Alan Leeds is a heavy dude, and did some great work for some great talents. And, you know, it didn't last long, but briefly Prince was scared. But and that's why Big Chick Huntsbury was there. That's the famous Prince bodyguard who used to carry him around. And but it's interesting, like Prince said later in an interview that Purple Rain was so traumatic, that the Purple Rain debut or opening night was so traumatic that he realized the whole world was an illusion when he got out of the purple limo at the debut, and he sees himself on a giant screen over the street, and it just totally flipped him out. And I think, I don't know if he'd already recorded Around the World in a Day at that point. My guess is he hadn't, because that album was like almost a deliberate attack on the Prince persona. It was such a break from Purple Rain, that, you know, that clearly he realized you don't want to go full Elvis, you know, never go full Elvis.
Yeah.
And pull back a little bit, you know, which is something Michael Jackson never did. And it might have made a huge difference if Michael had been able to, you know, kind of pull back from the stardom and the fame. But anyway, it's just massive success. When Doves Cry goes to number one, of course, that's the song that 17 Days was the B-side for, you know, and that came out before the movie. Massive number one hit, just a great song. I remember when that came on the radio, that was really when I knew 1984 was a special year. I mean, you know, Little Red Corvette was great and all, but When Doves Cry just blew everything away. It was such a revolutionary song, and you know, it was, you know, the success is history. Purple Rain's number one for 6 months, and you know, the rest is history, as they say. Any final thoughts on Prince and Purple Rain?
I say this chapter is so dense, and I actually cheated ahead because like you said, the Victory Tour chapter was so depressing.
Yeah.
And so I just read right after it, and it was such a juxtaposition. But what it also really portended was how it was a phenomenon, you know, like, and I'm not saying he was doing the same, I'm not claiming he was a Beatle, but, you know, it was bigger than anybody could imagine it was going to be, you know, it was equal to his talent, and his talent was equal to it. And I think I could see getting completely freaked out. Although what, you know, the quote he says is, reminds me of these recent articles I've read about people who are taking LSD for the first time. I mean, they say this stuff like that.
Yeah,
you know, they realize life's an illusion. And, you know, that just sounds like it was just super profound for him because he was that big.
Yeah.
You know, they knew what they knew it. It had heft. That's the thing. I mean, I thought Thriller was a great album, but Purple Rain had artistic heft. It just felt like it did.
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah. To me, Thriller felt like a collection of singles, really great singles. But Purple Rain to me is more of a cohesive whole. And then it's pretty stupid, I think, to try to split hairs about what's better, Thriller or Purple Rain.
True.
It's been a whole lifetime on that. They're both just incredible accomplishments. But I think part of it might be that Purple Rain scratched some of those rock album itches that Thriller really didn't. The Thriller was an R&B album all the way. I mean, it did have rock numbers on it, you know, but it wasn't a rock album in that same way that Purple Rain was. And, you know, Purple Rain probably has more filler on it than Thriller does. I mean, it's not much, sure. One or two songs in both cases, but they're not, I mean, that would be the hit single off a normal album, but, you know, Darling Nikki or whatever, Computer Blue is not as great as When Doves Cry, but you know, what is. Great fun talking about Prince with you. And next week, we're going to be talking about the indie underground as we continue our discussion of Michelangelo Matos's Can't Slow Down, how 1984 became pop's blockbuster year. So yeah, next week we'll be talking about REM and Black Flag and Husker Du and all those bands that I was listening to at the time. So for Ed Legg and Nate Wilcox, and we'll be back next week.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Roll Cast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Thursday, Nate kicks off a new series discussing the three kings of emo rap. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.